million miles away, we know how to use that in order to generate the power that we need. So that's what we should be doing.
Very quickly, Bill McKibben, Deb Haaland is about to be voted on by the full Senate. She would become the first Native American cabinet member in history, also very significant on the issue of fossil fuels. Your final thoughts?
Well, Deb Haaland is a great hero. It'll be wonderful to have her in that job because she comes from New Mexico, so she understands the importance of oil and gas revenues and the need to replace them as we move forward in this transition. But just the symbolism of it, Amy, couldn't be better. I mean, here's a descendant, first Native American cabinet member, and she'll have control over one-fifth of the acreage across the country that was taken from her people over these last hundreds of years. It's a signal moment, one of many signal moments in this new administration.
Bill McKibben, author, educator, environmentalist, co-founder of 350.org, thanks so much for joining us. That does it for the show. Happy birthday, Adriano Contreras. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, wear a mask.
Life during wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands, and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air. So we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 8:01 a.m. and it is Wednesday. Stay tuned for Wednesday Talk Radio with your hosts, Paul Rowland and Jacqueline Keeler. Stay tuned.
Hold your head up. Lift the top of your mind. Put your lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude? Are you here to improve or damn it? Look right now, and you will see we're only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life and oh,
carry it on.
We're saying,
oh, carry it on.
Keep
been introduced better there at the end of Democracy Now when they actually talked about the subject of our show this morning, Debra Haaland, which we're going to go a little deeper into today than follow up on our last month's conversation. What do you want to talk about this morning?
Well, I came right before I came on the show. Someone sent me an article from Wonkat, which is talking about Tucker Carlson. The title: Carlson filled with white pride over Deb Haaland's Scandinavian heritage.
That was a particularly egregious little bit there, and very telling. So, you want to talk about specifically the bile directed against her, and what the origins of that, and as a Native American woman, and I wanted to lead off maybe with a few facts about, as Bill McKibben said, she will be in a position to have a big say over one-fifth of the total land acreage in the United States, 507 million acres, which is quite astounding. And I just want to talk a little bit briefly about what the Department of Interior is. It manages 476 dams and 348 reservoirs through the Bureau of Reclamation, 410 national parks, monuments, seashore sites, etc., through the National Park Service, 544 national wildlife refuges through the Fish and Wildlife Service. It also includes the Bureau of Land Management, which has a massive acreage, and of course, you've talked a lot about that with the Bundys and the people who support the Hammonds, who I think both grazed their cattle on Bureau of Land Management land. And obviously, it also includes the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as well as the U.S. Geological Survey, and the Office of Subsurface Mining Reclamation and Enforcement. So a lot there. So talk about that Tucker Carlson article.
Yeah, well, I think there's a few articles that caught my thing. I thought maybe I'll just open the show by reading out the headlines, and maybe we can kind of react a little bit. Well, an article came out in the Huffington Post. It was reprinted also in Mother Jones, which looked at Trump, the emboldened. The headline is "Trump Emboldened Extremists. They could spell trouble for Biden's Interior Department." And it says experts worry it's only a matter of time before Biden's environmental agenda collides with anti-government militias. And this is by Chris D'Angelo. And actually, he does interview another Tory House author. My publisher has come out with two books this year. My book, Standoff, which looks at the Bundy takeovers and compares them to Standing Rock. And then also another author who her book looks directly at the Bundys. She did incredible interviews on the ground there. And she actually, I should say, allowed me to use her notes that she had taken with Cliven during interviews in 2014. Bessie Gaines Quammen, who has a book that's out right now about the Bundys. And so, and they do quote from Holland, which is sort of was our topic previously when we discussed Holland's nomination to the Interior Secretary. Holland then in her first, it quotes her saying she was in her first congressional term, and she stressed that these extremist ideologies did not develop in a vacuum. And she read a quote from former Senator Gene Heller, Republican Nevada, on the 2014 armed standoff between federal agents and militias at Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy's ranch, in which Heller praised the militiamen as patriots. And she noted that Nevada State Rep. Michelle Fayor had supported the armed militants who took control of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon in 2016. And she, Fayor, a Republican, dismissed the Bureau of Land Management at the time as a bureaucratic agency of basically terrorism. So this is, position that even if she gets even if she is confirmed, it's a pretty troubling position to be in. The way that the BLM is being characterized, and she will be a Native woman, a Native woman who has had the most control of the geographical area of the United States in history, and many, as you know, all the dams, everything that she is going to be overseeing, and it is giving. She's receiving a lot of pushback from Republicans, two Republicans, GOP senators, Senator Daines of Montana and Loomis of Wyoming. They wanted to force a debate on Holland's nomination, a debate that could last 30 hours, and Daines said in his statement, Senator Daines said her record is clear. She opposes pipelines and fossil fuels, ignores science when it comes to wildlife management, and wants to ban trapping on public lands.
Stop you so that clarify that debate. That's obviously some formal parliamentarian thing, that debate What would you know what that means?
Yeah, well, actually, Schumer apparently is moving to break that hold on her on the nomination process, so he's announced that the Senate will start the confirmation process for her this week, and that a final vote, however, isn't likely until next week. So what they're trying to do is just eat up hours, you know, take an extra, make the Senate, you know, dedicate up to 30 hours, extra hours on discussing her nomination, something that's not been done with any other, you know, Interior Secretary. And but she only needs 50 votes to be confirmed, so it's pretty sure that she will be confirmed from the Senate. So
yeah, she's definitely getting under people's skin. She's in a way their worst nightmare.
Yeah,
woman and native.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's you know, in I don't know if you saw the video of her confirmation hearing, but you know where I can't remember the senator's name, but he was a doctor. And he was challenging a tweet that she had issued in probably in 2020, stating that Republicans, hate science or something like that. And so, he was very upset because he and three other Republicans are doctors, medical doctors, and how can she say that they hate science, even though they reject climate science, right? Now, none of them are, you know, have doctorates in that field. But it is really troubling that they're trying to say that just because they're doctors and they don't care about the science regarding climate change, which most scientists agree, you know, over 99% of scientists agree is an issue, that in any way is a criticism of her rather than of them as actual physicians and people who should be caring about things like, environmental pollution, things that create disparate outcomes for different populations. They should be paying attention to that science.
Yeah, I was the whole issue of environmental racism, which she's sort of had fits and starts over various administrations, starting with Clinton through Obama. It will be really interesting to see how she carries forward that debate.
Well, she has spoken out quite a bit about environmental racism, and I think that Bill McKibben sort of touched on that a bit about her being from New Mexico, and she has spoken a great deal, of course, about Chaco Canyon and also about her own pueblo, Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico, which has has the largest uranium mine, I think, in the world. There and has created a great deal of environmental racism, I guess, is an expression of environmental racism that saw Native communities as disposable. And in my own family, I should say, in full disclosure, the community of Cameron, Arizona, on the Navajo Nation, where my family is from, my mother is from, is dotted with abandoned uranium mines, which is very concerning.
Indeed. So back to what you brought up about the right-wing extremists, and I didn't realize that in October 2019 she actually led a House subcommittee hearing on the effects of anti-government extremism on federal land management officials, who she will now be, presumably, if this goes through, and it looks like it will, that she will be overseeing, which is very interesting. And then just in addition, everything just got ratcheted up about 20 notches with the insurrection on January 6th, which brings all this stuff into the glaring spotlight.
Yeah, it's that's really, you can see why the Republicans are very nervous, and of course, I think that they bring up the issue of jobs over and over again in their questioning of her, and that she's going to hurt jobs in their communities. And I actually, in the book I edited about Bear's Ears, I devoted an entire chapter to addressing the question of jobs. You know, quite often, what I found when I was reporting on the ground was that, the first thing that white citizens in San Juan County, Utah, would bring up was the issue of jobs, 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 you know, versus the environment. And you know, in my book, I make the, you know, I talk a lot about colonialism and being a colonist and the history of even the word jobs, which, of course, is based in an act of theft. You're taking part in a con job, right? And which, you know, workers in England used originally as a disparaging term for job, for that kind of work, right? And because it was sort of new. And so I devoted a whole chapter to it, to addressing the question. And I felt that basically the book is called Edge of Morning, Native Voices Speak for the Bear's Ears, but I basically felt that the issue of jobs versus the issue of how we relate to the land as Indigenous people is deeply tied to the way, and I tried to make the point that the kind of interaction that a people have with the land is in itself a form of wealth, right? The things that we get being with each other that way, with our interactions with Mother Earth, right, has a value in itself. And in some ways, it has a greater value. And this expresses itself in various ways, in social capital, in materially, in things like the development of things like corn, crops that have fed the world, right, made the place a better, more, provided more food for more people across the world. And these are all indigenous to the United States, to this hemisphere, I should say, and they are a result of a people's interaction with the land, right? With and so, what I try to make the argument is that this interaction is probably provided more wealth to the world than what they could dig out of the ground, right? Out of take from Mother Earth, right? These resources. So, like, I did a comparison between the Potosi mines in South America that the Spaniards, used and killed tens of thousands of Indian people mining those silver mines, working them to death. And yet, you know, still at the end of it, you know, the Spanish king was still, you know, bankrupt. Because so it's when you compare that to even social ideas that grow out of this relationship Indigenous people have with the land, like concepts of women's rights, which really grew out of the Iroquois Confederacy and the Great Law of Peace, right? And so these concepts inspired women. They inspired the, you know, of course, the meeting at Seneca Falls with, you know, all those famous early suffragettes, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and all these folks. And that then how has that made lives better for women across the world? I mean, literally billions of people. And how is, and you know, study after study shows that when women, you know, have more control over their lives, that the entire community benefits financially. So what is the financial gain out of the social relationships that Indigenous people have with the land versus simple extraction? That was my goal in this. So
totally. And it makes me think of, you know, going back to the very origins of the arrival of Europeans and the extreme narrow-minded worldview and prejudices that they had. I mean, the idea of, you know, the idea basically that they considered the native people as basically not. I mean, they were looking at the world through the world that they came from, which was a very diseased world in terms of, you know, total feudal control and very little, you know, people were looking to be free from the rigidity of Europe, but also the, you know, they only knew the kind of production systems that were there. They didn't have the ability to actually just get what they needed to survive from directly, you know, whether fishing or hunting or gathering. And so they looked at those as inferior. And so then they had to create a whole job system by imposing agriculture and mining and the rest, basically.
Yeah, in my book Standoff, I actually give a really quite in-depth look at the at the rise of industrialism, the industrial state in Britain, particularly in England. And because of the Bundys, Cliven Bundy is always talking about the closing of the commons. He's thinking about things that happened during the English Civil War. And the closing of the commons was, of course, where, you know, English peasants, you know, had their villages basically torn down by landlords, and then the lands that they once held in common privatized, right? And then enclosure refers to, of course, that whole process, which meant laws were passed for a couple hundred years in the English Parliament, allowing enclosure of common land. And if you could pay to fence it, then you owned it, basically. And so poor people couldn't afford to fence their commonly owned lands, because often they only owned a strip, so the fencing would have to be quite extensive. And so they were pushed off the land. Their homelessness was then criminalized, right? And as vagrancy, and then they were often sentenced to workhouses, and then entire families and forced to work for starvation wages in factories. And then of course this is where the Mormons came in when they first started their recruitment overseas. The first places they went to were these places, Liverpool and Manchester, to recruit from. Really, people who were on the brink of starvation in this system, English people, and bring them to Utah. And when Utah was declared a state, I mean, nearly 30% of the population was born in England and in overseas because of this recruitment. And so, this is sort of the history they're bringing to it in the perspective. And this is deeply tied to this concept of jobs, of this very extractive use of the environment, and part and parcel of the colonization process. So what you're seeing here in this nomination fight is a fight between two very different worldviews, and I don't put it past the Republicans to tap into the Trump base and the sort of and this potential armed militia response.
Indeed, this is KBOO Community Radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Roland, regular weekly host, and I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host, and we're continuing a conversation we started last week about the nomination of Deborah Holland, the Laguna Pueblo nominee for head of the Secretary of the Interior Department. And now we're talking about nomination hearings and some of the pushback, some of the racist characterizations and misogynist characterizations of her. And the number to call in and join the conversation is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. Both I and Jacqueline are on the phone, but we do have Sonia operating the board at our KBOO studios, so feel free to call in. I also have a Facebook page. That's KBOO Wednesday Talk Radio. You can always like that, and you can send me comments there. So, Tucker Carlson filled with white pride over Deb Haaland's Scandinavian heritage. What a great headline.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and here you have the... of course, Tucker Carlson is himself from a very wealthy family, and of course he's become, the spokesperson for incredibly, an expression of the of this really vicious reaction to a decentering of a white supremacist colonialism, he asked. His question is, what does Deb Haaland plan to do with all this new power? So they're very concerned. She's going to be an incredibly powerful Native woman. And again, I would love to hear from your callers what they think of this idea that Native woman will be in charge of the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, and all the other agencies that are under the Bureau of Land of the Department of the Interior. And water reclamation, all sorts of things, and And, you know, when white men have been approved of this position, there hasn't been a lot of discussion like this, you know. And so it's it would be very, very curious to hear. Of course, Tucker is trying to deflect to, oh, my gosh, no, that she's getting a pass because of the way she looks, right? Which is very ironic because, you know, every study shows that, you know, in a white supremacist society, white privilege means getting a pass for the way you look. Do you know what I mean? You know, they often say people judge people within the first 5 seconds of meeting them, and these are very hard set, you know, judgments. And a lot of it is based on the way the person looks, you know, and being white, being Blanca, being sort of blank, you know, gives you a certain pass. You get past that 5 second moment, and you get to kind of express yourself as a person. While if you are not white, then you have to contend with a whole series of stereotypes, and most of which are very negative. And so it's kind of ironic that he's trying to twist this around. And so it's funny because, you know, I mean, yes, her father may be of Norwegian descent, but nobody in the world would look at her and think Norwegian. And she certainly doesn't, get... the sort of, you know, she's not seen through that lens in a society that is so color conscious.
And she's maintained her close ties to her community, which is, I guess,
well,
the all important,
you know,
thing.
And for him, for Tucker Carlson, the issue is color, right? The color of someone's skin and hair and eyes. But for Native people, particularly for Pueblo people, it's based on your matrilineal descent. So, you know, and the same thing with the Navajo people and my husband's people, the Iroquois people, who you are is who your mother is. So your clan is passed down through your maternal line. So her mother is Laguna Pueblo. So in the traditional way of looking at it, she is Laguna Pueblo. In the same way that because my mother is Navajo, I am Navajo. I am Kniaani Nishlith, you know, and I'm born for my father's people. You know, which would be my grandmother, my paternal grandmother's people, and so early to both of my grandfathers, you know, after that, and so there is this, you know, I've had Navajo people come out to me and say, you know, you're constantly talking about your dad's family, but you're Navajo, that's who you are. Do you know what I mean? In our traditional way, in indigenous ways of looking at it, you are what your mother is. That's who you are, and almost entirely. Do you know what I mean? And so that's pretty much. So you see two conflicting worldviews once again expressed in this.
Well, we do have a caller. Let me just ask Joe to hold on just a second because I just want to follow through because saying it's ironic is I guess to say the least that Tucker Carlson is. Is focused on this. I mean, we've talked a lot over the years on this program and about the what is behind this, the virulence of these reactionists, these right-wing extremists that kind of came to full fruition on January 6th in the insurrection. And it's this, you know, this massive demographic shift away from whiteness. And also just a general cultural shift towards women gaining more power, people of color gaining more, you know, cultural visibility and prominence. This cultural shift, and so obviously arrogant white frat boys like Tucker Carlson are going to go apoplectic in the face of someone like. Deb Haaland, though.
Yeah, I mean, the data certainly shows that white men still are very centered. You know, you look at the data coming out of different places that measure representation, whether you're talking in Hollywood or, you know, with VITA, with literature, or with, you know, of course, CEOs of major corporations. White men still centered largely. And certainly this election, the presidential election, is that was a big part of it as well. So, but yeah, I'll let our caller call in. And
well, I think he apparently has left, had to go do something maybe, but maybe Joe will call back. But other people are free to call in and speak with Jacqueline Keeler and myself at 503-231-8187. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I certainly didn't mean that the, you know, that the white patriarchal power system has shifted in any major way, but they're obviously, you know, so defensive and so fragile that anything that seems like a threat to their privilege and power seems to be met with what we're seeing, huh?
Yeah. I mean, well, from callers about how they feel about a Native woman being in control of 75% of federal public land and many other things that they have that she has to look after. And I'm very excited actually about you know, how she's going to deal with tribes. And of course, this is very worrying to Republicans as well. And she you know, she made a point in the hearing to discuss the impact of COVID-19 on Native communities and tribes, and she brought up the issue of Navajos being subjected to polluted water, which is a serious issue for the largest Native nation in the United States, living in a desert area where so much of the drinking water has been used for extractive industries. Actually, you know, the aquifer, the Navajo Hopi aquifer, has had billions of gallons taken out of it to slurry coal, right? And then, of course, that coal power plants, those two coal power plants in the Four Corners area, have been shut down simply because they are not financially making money anymore. But the methane cloud over the Four Corners area is still visible from space, right? And methane is incredibly more you know, many factors more damaging than carbon.
Is that because all the fracking going on?
No, because of the power plants, the coal burning power plants that function there for decades, right, have created this huge methane cloud over the Four Corners area that is visible from space. And and you know, of course, you talk about, you know, you mentioned environmental racism. This is definitely a reflection of it. And of course, the Navajo people, you know, are the largest tribe in the United States. They have the largest land base. And they have the greatest potential for carrying on their culture. You know, we have over 120,000 fluent speakers of language. We have, you know, the population to carry on the culture in a meaningful way. And yet it's constantly threatened by U.S. interests in jobs and extraction. And so, but she did say in the hearing that she will, you know, that she will work to make sure that the voice of tribal nations are heard on these issues.
And it'll be interesting what influence she'll be able to have with Biden and Harris, too. Anyway, we do have a caller. Kathy has been waiting. Go ahead, Kathy. What have you got to say?
Oh, hi. Good morning. First of all, I just wanted to thank Jacqueline for her incredible work and how much she is teaching us about the Native, you know, views of the world. I'm just always really learning a lot whenever she's on. And also, you asked how the listeners felt about Deb Haaland, and, you know, I certainly support her. I think she sounds fantastic. But I had a question I wanted to ask, if you know about the whole biofuels issue, because I'm just finding out that biofuel power plants are using wood that's cut down, freshly cut down trees, and in some cases clear cuts, even though they're supposed to be just using things like slash or the products of thinning, which of course is often questionable as well. But there's a whole bunch of them around the country. They're called biofuel power plants, and I'm afraid that they may be pushing for more because they get actually funding as renewable energy. They're getting grants, and they're getting some government bypass in Oregon. They're qualified as carbon neutral, even though they're actually polluting. And of course, we need our trees. And also, of course, corn biofuels is another issue. And that. So I was just wondering if you know much about that, or if that has an influence on the reservation at all.
Yeah, Cassie, I don't know. Oh, sorry. I don't know if tribes are participating in that program or not. But I do agree that it is really a terrible use of our forests. I'd be very interested to see. I think that the you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that that the public lands that the Department of the Interior oversees includes the Forest Service, does it? That's separate.
No, that's the Department of Agriculture. But yeah. I think Bureau of Land Management lands could possibly. I mean, I'm sure it'll touch the Department of Interior. I'm not sure it'll be a huge issue on her radar, since there's so many issues. But I agree, it's a travesty, this whole greenwashing of biofuels, which are definitely impacting our forest lands.
Yeah, so I'll look into that. That sounds very, very important and interesting, and I would be very curious if any tribes are participating in that program. I have heard of of instances where tribes tribes do a very good job managing their resources for the most part, but I have heard of instances where they have been able to duck the requirements on circumference to meet certain standards. I reported on that many years ago, so I don't remember all the details, but yeah, I could definitely look into that. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thank you for calling and asking that question, Kathy. Anybody else have any comments or questions for Jacqueline Keeler and myself? Paul Rowland, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And we've got we're about halfway through the program. And we've been talking about Deborah Holland, the nominee who's going through a grueling confirmation process, which I guess was expected, since she is, after all, the first Native American nominee for a cabinet position, and she kind of goes against everything that the current Republicans stand for.
I would like to hear your opinion, Paul, about what you feel about a Native woman heading the Department of the Interior.
Well, obviously, I guess my first sort of superficial comment would be, It depends a lot which Native woman, obviously, because could imagine a Native woman that could be appointed by, well, not likely by a Trump, but by someone else who was,
you mean like Tara Sweeney, who was Trump's appointee to head the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean. But that aside,
opening up ANWR and everything like that. Yeah.
You could easily see someone being used in a very cynical way, but she is obviously not that person. She, by all everything I've seen, she's amazing. she's the right person at the right time for the right job, and it's extremely exciting for me to, I've been advocating for Native causes for quite a long time. I've had close ties at different times with Native communities, including here in the Pacific Northwest, fought alongside people, worked under the direction of Native women, and had a lot of respect for that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think what a better point of view and perspective than someone like Deborah Holland coming from the Laguna Pueblo and where she comes from, and overseeing the Department of Interior, which includes so many departments, including the Department, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, is kind of breathtaking in a way, and it's almost hard to believe it could happen.
Yeah, I mean, the agency employs 70,000 people, manages 500 million acres of federal land, almost a fifth of the United States, and of course, as the Republican, senators were noting, sets policies for natural resource extraction, right? And so it will be very interesting. And you know, this issue of her potentially facing, the issue of the militia. Do you feel that's a real issue? I mean, I don't know how, from your perspective, what you've seen. I think, you know, obviously talking directly and looking at these folks close up and seeing how Trump sort of deployed them when he needed to make a political point, and even seeing them storming the Capitol, right? And I don't feel like Trump has gone away, really. You know, I think he still has incredible power in the Republican Party.
Well, I just hope she has some good bodyguards. No, I mean, you know, I think, yeah. I guess my fear, and I've heard a lot of other people say this, is that sort of, you know, since Trump didn't get reelected, since their first stab at a coup attempt failed, you know, since sort of the united energy around that time where you had a really large rally of a lot of, you know, probably the biggest concentration of those forces arrayed at one time, and they've suffered, some major setbacks, and a lot of people are going to go to prison, you know, they're going to lose a lot of their major organizers. The fear is that you're going to have a kind of a split up, a splinter factionalization, where you're going to have an increasing sort of desperate radicalization of individuals who might resort to extreme acts. I mean, that's, a realistic fear. So, yeah, I mean, I think people are going to need to be very careful, but it's definitely not a time to shrink back. It's a time to move forward decisively. And I don't know. Yeah, it's both a sort of an optimistic time despite everything, and also kind of a scary time. Hard to know where it's all going to go, really.
Yeah, I see here in that article in Huffington Post, they quoted Steve Pettery, who is the conservation director at Oregon Wild. And he says, quite frankly, he says he expects Holland will be tested early. And he says, it's unfortunate, but I guarantee we'll see the Bundys pull something again. And in fact, they note that Bundy has already threatened violence. In an interview in January, he warned that he and his allies would walk forward towards guns if a new administration attempted to collect long overdue grazing fees and round up his cattle. I guess it's from Clive and Bundy. So, not Ammon Bundy. But Ammon Bundy, of course, has been also training the son. Ammon Bundy has been training a militia force in Idaho to basically confront any governmental attempts to enforce any sort of COVID restrictions.
Right, and of course, for those, everybody knows, but Cliven Bundy is the Nevada rancher who had a standoff with the feds a number of years ago and got off scot-free, and then his two sons showed up and helped take over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and had a standoff, which you've written about and have a new book about, and also got off scot-free, and so they're still out there and still emboldened.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, Bundy also praised, Clive and Bundy, I should say, praised the violent mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6th, and he wrote on Facebook, "You can't clean the swamp by standing off at a distance and smelling it." And
uh-huh.
This is interesting because I feel like the Bundys were not so pro-Trump for a while there, but basically he's referencing Trump's campaign slogan of draining the swamp of special interest in D.C. And then they also quoted Aaron Weiss, who's the deputy director of the Center for Western Priorities, and he worries that this is a powder keg just waiting for a light. And he says, "I do not think it's not an if, but a when." Right. So, I mean, this, of course, is... of course, this movement has been emboldened by Trump, and he's continuing to send messages to them, and the CPAC speech that he gave recently, and I think that it's still the problem is, of course, that the rural areas are very Republican, and have a lot of representation, maybe one could say over-representation in Congress and the Senate, just due to the way those, you know, we calculate those things. And of course, the Republicans have tried very hard to prevent, you know, people of color from being counted in voting. I think I had heard that there were over almost 80 different proposals in different state legislatures to basically reduce access to voting, including a tax on the mail-in vote, right? And then also the issue of the way the U.S. Census was handled under the Trump administration in order to sort of prevent counting of people, particularly people of color. And so they are trying everything they can to stop the political power of people of color from becoming a factor in future, reducing its efficacy in future elections.
The battle lines are starkly drawn, for sure. It looks like we got another caller. Arthur has been waiting patiently. Let's go to see what Arthur has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Over here on the northwest here, there's talk about removing two or three dams, and I'm wondering if Deborah Holland's nomination, if she'll give any impetus to that effort. I'm just curious about that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, I know that dam removal has been a real has been really an issue led by tribes, particularly here in the Pacific Northwest. And so I do see that in 2020, Representative Holland, along with other congresspeople, including Representative Grijalva of Arizona, they actually issued a statement to urge them to move forward. To Warren Buffett, they wrote a letter in September 2020 to urge him to move forward with an agreement to remove four aging dams on the Klamath River, owned by PacifiCorps and Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. And she definitely has been on the record of supporting dam removal, I would say.
Okay, well, let's looks like we already got another caller right up on stack. I just want to again mention that since Jackie and I are both on phone lines, we're occupying one of the phone patch systems to get callers at KBOO, and so there's only one line open for listeners. So that's why you may not be able to get through, but Susan has gotten through, and she's on the line. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi. I've been reading a little bit about some of the Oregon ranchers and their connections with Washington, D.C. And I'm curious, because I haven't been able to find, just through browsing some publications online, whether or not Casey Hammond, who is a special assistant in the Interior Department, I think in metals and something else. I just don't have it in front of me right now. But I was wondering if he was related at all to Dwight and Stephen Hammond, H-A-M-M-O-N-D. Because Casey Hammond has been getting some regulations revised and has one.
We lost you. Darn it. In mid-sentence, even. Well, I guess you got the gist of the question, whether you have any idea whether this Casey Hammond is related to the famous Hammonds from Eastern Oregon.
Yeah, I am not sure about that. There's a great website called the Department of Influence.org, right? And it's, I think it was created by maybe the Center of Western... but it's who created this website? It was created by the Western Values Project to document the revolving door between special interest lobbyists and political appointees of the Department of the Interior, and to expose how that revolving door influences decisions made by the department And so they have they updated up until fairly recently, basically since January. They hadn't been updating it, but it's a great resource for finding out who's who working has been in the past in the Department of the Interior. And there is a Casey Hammond has his own. He was the acting Assistant Secretary of Land and Mineral Management, and it doesn't say here he has any ties to that family. He's very.
Does he say where he's from?
He's actually worked in Washington D.C. for 2 decades, and seeing where he's originally from. And he particularly was working, you know, pertinent to folks here in Oregon. He was working on the sage-grouse review team, which looks at sage-grouse management plans, which is a big issue here in Oregon to preserve their habitat. And but he's very connected with the Property Rights Foundation of America, the Independent Petroleum Association of America, you know, so you can get a sense of where he's coming from. If he's not an actual relative, he's definitely a relative in spirit. And so he's but he's a long time. He has very close contact with the oil and gas industry, and so.
Of course, Hammond is a fairly common name, but it'd be interesting if there did happen to be a connection. Maybe we'll try to look at it. But Susan's back. Maybe we'll just let you follow up with another question or comment.
Oh, well, I was thinking I read that he was from Montana, so or maybe I'm sorry, you know, if I know he's been active in D.C. for a couple of decades, but you know, family's family, and so that's what I was trying to find connection. And I also lived in Alaska, and he's been very active in trying to get lands freed up for drilling up there. I'm sorry, just that I didn't realize you were going to have this caller today, and I don't have any of my notes in front of me other than what I have.
Maybe this could be your research project. Look
yes.
Deeper into the Hammond connection and get back to us with that if you want. But thank you for calling, Susan. We got only about a little less than 10 minutes left, 503-231-8187, to join in the conversation about Deborah Holland, about the Interior Department, about right-wing extremists and public land, and much else with Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host, and myself, Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio. So, yeah, I mean, this Hammond is obviously just one of the many, many Trump appointees who've been doing things like deconstructing the to what extent it's actually a good regulatory process is debatable, but the regulatory process as it exists, his version of so-called draining the swamp, but it's just in. He just implanted his own more vile swamp creatures, is what I can see.
Yeah, and also a really interesting appointee under Trump, of course, was the Cliven Bundy's attorney, former attorney. What is her name again? She is the one who actually developed the county supremacy ideology that they utilize.
Mm-hmm.
What is her name? Forgetting her name right now. Oh, geez. She was the and there were other folks from her group. She's an attorney, Karen Bud Fallon was her name, and she was actually up for the director of the Bureau of Land Management, which is the same agency that she sued for decades under RICO, actually suing agency staff for enforcing laws and suing them as being as racketeering, you know, and for the enforcement of regulations, the federal regulations. So she was actually the deputy solicitor, actually for Parks and Wildlife, and under Trump, and now she has stepped down, of course. And but her nomination for to head the BLM was held up because they actually were requiring her to actually sell her ranch in Wyoming, her family ranch, which is kind of an unusual thing. So, but yeah, but she's a major thought leader in the Sagebrush Rebellion movement, and part of a legal group, Montana State's Legal Foundation, which has been really you know, providing the leadership, you know, and legal basically support to this very far right movement. And and so yeah, that was very troubling when she was head of that. And so I think that the director of that legal foundation also yeah, so it's it was actually founded by James Watt. And so yeah. And then Trump picked William Perry Penley, who once argued that federal government shouldn't possess land, and to be head of the BLM as well.
Well, you know what I'm really interested in, speaking of these former appointments who are all going to be, either have been, have resigned, or going to be fired, presumably. But this is obviously getting way ahead of ourselves. It'll be really interesting to see what sort of, I mean, just so does she have the power to name, like, the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or is that also a presidential appointee?
Yeah, it's usually, he's already been, Biden has been appointing a lot of folks already, and so so that's been very, very positive. I'm pretty sure that he's added other natives to his roster. And I know that Walia Johns, a Navajo woman, has been appointed to head the U.S. Office of Indian Energy Programs and Policy. And
right.
Yeah, and so and I think he also appointed the first gay Native man to lead a program as well. And of course, he is restored. I think he has decided to make. Let's see. He's also he's brought back the tribal the White House you know, tribal meetings that Obama had started and that
right.
Trump had abandoned. So he's bringing that back as well, and I think that he's making a Native position actually cabinet position.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That'll be that's a step forward as well. Well, I just want to give people a final chance to call in. We only have like 3 or 4 minutes left. 503-231-8187. If you have a quick comment or question for Jacqueline Keeler, our second Wednesday co-host, always talking about what's going on in Indian country and behind the scenes. We're talking about Deborah Holland today. So we talked about Tucker Carlson, and what are some of the other, you were going to mention some of the more virulent things that had come out during the confirmation hearings. Anything you want to flag in particular?
Well, you know, I think that Tucker Carlson's response is ludicrous. I mean, to most people, obviously Deb Holland, you know, is half Norwegian, but that doesn't play into how America sees her, right? And it's an interesting moment. I mean, the idea that, and to see the sort of, I mean, watching, it was very difficult to watch that nomination hearing and see the way these white men were just, it was just really disgusting. I mean, I was, you know, we are all very well aware of misogyny and racism, but to see it, you know, like that is hard sometimes, you know. And But I felt she handled herself very well. I felt that she definitely has the perspective, and there's no way the Republican Party will ever support the kind of positions that she holds on resource extraction. Yet they are sensible positions, I think, for the future. And so I think she did a good job of answering their questions and yet not. you know, not giving away anything, basically. And I felt that bodes really well for her. I mean, I know there's a lot of concern that she's sort of, I think she's in her 60s, but she is new to politics. It's, you know, this was her first national office as congresswoman from New Mexico, and she's still in her first term. And so this was, you know, how she was going to do, and she appears to be doing very well. And she, I felt she did a great job. And so I think that, you know, and she has a lot of support for her nomination, at least for the Democratic Party. And some Republicans, of course, you know, like Murkowski and the usual swing voters. And, but, you know, I mean, so it's, so yeah, I think it's, I'm excited. It will be really, and I really, I do think I need to sit down and write about this sort of, it's almost like a change of consciousness in America to have a Native woman in charge of one fifth of the country. You know, what does that even mean? I think that we haven't even begun to understand that. But, you know, of course, there is the flip side, which is the danger. It will put her in danger as well, you know, and yet, so we still have a very divided country. And the country is still guided by principles that are difficult to have in a multi-ethnic, multi-pluralistic, multi-racial, pluralistic society, right?
Well, I hear our theme music coming up, so it sounds like the show is over right about now. So thank you once again, Jackie. Really good to hear your perspective on everything, and appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Okay, bye, everybody.
Hey, Bluegrass lovers! Tune in Saturday, March 13th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for a very special quarantine version of the Bluegrass Marathon from your friends at Music from the True Vine.
This year's marathon will feature homespun